I'm Bill Bunbury. Welcome to Hindsight and Religions Old and New. It's the fifth program in our series, View from the North, Glimpses of Northern Australian History. Today, meeting points between Christian missionaries and Indigenous people in Northern Australia, especially in the Northern Territory.
Missionaries were, from the earliest days, very active in bringing to light atrocities that were committed. Many mission stations were refuges, havens for Aboriginal people who were escaping danger from hunting gangs and so on. The presence of those missionaries enabled Aboriginal people to have a safe haven, and also their presence meant that there was less shooting, less atrocity.
From my position, I think a lot of Indigenous people could have stayed in a lot of their own country and not being put on big mission areas or on reserves. I think that's caused a lot of the conflict that we're experiencing today.
Indigenous educator at the Northern Territory University, Linda Ford, and John Harris, himself the son of a missionary, and author of One Blood, 200 Years of Aboriginal Encounter with Christianity. It's impossible to generalise about this history because experience varied so widely. Aboriginal people encountered different missionaries from different denominations, in different regions, and at different times in the 19th and 20th centuries. So what we'll hear today is more of a kaleidoscope of that story. We'll try to trace a central theme, the clash and sometimes convergence of two different stories, messages and experiences. For Aboriginal people, the arrival of missionaries meant a different but still recognisable aspect of colonialism. For missionaries, many of them from Europe, it involved the unfamiliarity of working in a new country and in a rapidly changing frontier, a territory where pastoralists and their livestock were fast altering the way of life of Aboriginal people.
The very first missionaries that came to Australia failed. Their missions didn't last long. There were very few converts. Some of them went back home or they went into other kinds of occupations. This indeed is not to criticise the missionaries. To be blunt about it, they often came out to Australia from remote places with no idea of what it was going to be like in Australia, went from Germany or England or somewhere to the middle of Australia, and of course they found that life was very difficult and impossible for them. And so by the 1850s there was failure.
John Harris. Deborah Bird Rose has explored the history of the 19th century Jesuit mission at Daly River, a good 150 kilometres south of Darwin.
What they were looking for was the pure, unadulterated savage. And what they found in Rapid Creek was Aboriginal people who'd already been contaminated, as they would put it, by civilization. So they went down to the Daly in the erroneous belief that they would find pure savages down there. Why they wanted those who were pure was that they saw that as soon as Aborigines were colonized, white people brought out the worst in themselves as colonizers, and they brought out the worst in the people they colonized. And it set up a situation in which nobody, neither whites nor blacks, really wanted missionaries hanging around. So they really wanted to be the first white people to civilize them before colonization ruined them. Was sort of, I mean, you can't really get a stable narrative out of those kinds of dichotomies either, because colonization is civilization on the frontier. So they couldn't make sense of that. A number of them, Father Kristen in particular, was looking for the lost tribes of Israel. He had a narrative that eventually drove him insane, but it kept him going with great fire and vigor for quite some time. And once they'd crossed that cultural boundary, north of which Aboriginal people didn't circumcise or don't circumcise today, and south of which they do, and he started seeing circumcised men, he really felt that he was in the vicinity of the lost tribes. And then he started doing his language studies and trying to find the correspondences between Hebrew and Mulek.
Did he find them?
Yes. You know, if you know what you're looking for, you can usually find it, whether it's there or not.
Were they assuming then, in the light of what you've just said, that these people were a tabula rasa? You could imprint the gospel, as it were, on them, because
it was assumed they had no other belief system that would stand up to that kind of pressure?
That's right, that they were wandering in the darkness and that these were the bringers of light.
And how did that work out?
Well, they did make some converts, and some of those converts, as I read the evidence, were genuine converts. We're talking about the late 1800s, and we've actually got documentation that gives some insight into the ways in which indigenous people were endeavoring to make sense of Christianity and endeavoring really to become Christian. So that aspect of it's quite interesting. They also made a lot of enemies. They were extremely vigorous in their efforts to suppress ceremony. They were extremely vigorous in their efforts to suppress the whole mode of subsistence. They wanted to suppress all the indigenous sociality, the trade, and so on. They were particularly horrible to women, and that seems to me coming out of their own views on the sinfulness of women. But also they never ever did seem to understand that women there had their own law. I mean, I think the idea of women holding law was completely anathema to them. So they never understood that it was there. So some of their interruptions of women's rights to their own bodies and their own law were particularly nasty. But they were pretty awful to some of the men, too. They particularly took a set against some of the senior lawmen, because those were the guys who were holding a lot of the culture together in defiance of missionaries. And so quite correctly, I suppose, they targeted them as people who really needed to be suppressed.
Going back to the women, do you think that was in part their own celibate state that made it more difficult?
Well, it certainly gave them problems, and one or more of the brothers slipped and fathered at least one child. It's interesting. I mean, the way I know this, I should acknowledge, they kept a detailed daily diary in Latin, and that diary then obviously didn't say everything, but it was honest enough to talk about things like that. So we know that at least one of the brothers slipped.
Deborah Bird Rose and the Jesuits at Daly River. You're with Hindsight on Radio National. I'm Bill Bunbury, and we're exploring 19th century missionary contact with Aboriginal people in Northern Australia.
For the Jesuits themselves, this was also displacement, wasn't it? I mean, they must have felt very uprooted from that neat green country of Austria to be plunged into the Australian wilderness. Are there comments they make about this?
Well, they were completely baffled by it in many, many ways, and it shows up all over the place. But really the classic, Bill, is their statement that the Daily looked nothing like the Danube. The diarist who wrote this said it had a soft, soapy taste, like an extract, as it were, of alligators.
But there were observers of the Jesuits themselves.
Knut Dahl was a delightful outsider and a really keen observer. It makes you realize that sometimes your best sources aren't going to be the trained social scientists. They're actually going to be the trained observers who have no particular views one way or another about what they're observing. So this guy was a naturalist. He was observing the natural world, and he observed the Jesuits and he observed the Aborigines with pretty much the same lack of theoretical commitment to any particular position. And he did find the Jesuits somewhat amusing.
The Jesuit argues, let us first of all persuade these savages to give up their roving life. Let us teach them to cultivate the soil, and let us make them understand that their work in this way brings them greater happiness, makes them more carefree than their old life. Then, possibly, their progeny, the new tribes of settled agriculturalists, may be more susceptible to our religious propaganda. Northern Territory Anglican Bishop Philip Freer has described the history of the Mitchell River Anglican Mission on the eastern edge of the Gulf of Carpentaria. It was soon evident here that these missionaries could not always find the time for, quote, religious propaganda.
Very quickly, and it's probably after a number of years, the missionary effort gets tied up with a whole lot of institutional things, just about how a mission station could be maintained and how people being encouraged away from their traditional mode of economy could be sustained by other means, by agricultural means in a fairly hostile environment. So that becomes an all-consuming thing, and I think there's a strong policy of what you could call a civilizing mission, that in one respect there is developing the habits of European society and European civilization as almost a precursor to evangelization.
Does that affect things like polygamy, sexual custom, normal relations as they perceived it between indigenous people, which are, in the missionaries' view, wrong?
Yeah, I think this is it becomes a fairly complex story throughout it all, but there are distinctions in the missionaries' minds as to who is an inmate of the mission. And at various times there are attempts to represent the mission by fencing a mission square. I know very early in the life of the mission, Gilbert White leaves an instruction that no naked Aborigine should be allowed to enter there, and he sets up this elaborate scheme where there can be some loincloth left at the entrance to the mission proper so that people might be aware they're entering some kind of different domain. So there's a whole geographical ordering of space, and I think a social ordering of people. So the people who come to be associated as adherents of the mission, they have a whole lot of expectations about behaviour that probably the people who are living more as just casual acquaintances with the mission don't have. So you get these distinctions between what they'll sometimes refer to as wild blacks and mission inmates, and various degrees of people moving across those boundaries. And so it isn't a consistent story, as if there is this great project initially to change a whole lot of people's culture, but there is this sense that those who come to be closely associated with the mission will take on some of the habits of what I perceive to be the culture of that as an institution.
You look at Hermannsburg, and it was a Lutheran mission, and the Lutherans, as with the other denominations at the time, they had a very straight line in what they saw. You were either a Christian with the potential for civilising, or you weren't. And so you were a pagan or a heathen if you were an Aboriginal. It's clearly stated in the time. It's the context of the era. It was believed much more widely. Individuals occasionally didn't see it that way, but what you had is this perception. And I think the old Lutheran ministers were perceived in some ways as almost the same as the old Aboriginal leaders. They were very firm. They were very hard. There was only one road to follow. So in a way, they were parallel sorts of people. And there was an appreciation that you didn't deviate. Everyone knew where you stood. And there was a clear, devout belief in your God, in the case of the Lutherans, and there was a devout belief in the case of the Aboriginal people.
Central Australian historian Dick Kimber. You're with Hindsight on Radio National. John Kadiba has studied the history of Methodist missions in Arnhem Land in the early 20th century. Here it seems the missions adopted a one-way approach.
Up until World War II, and even in the 50s, missionaries made little effort to learn the languages of the Aboriginal people or to understand their culture. And so, as far as Christianization, the aim of Christianization of the Aborigines was concerned, they made little headway because they made no attempt to understand and to contextualize Christianity in its Western form to the Aboriginal culture.
It seems pretty clear that a lot of Aboriginal people in the area who didn't convert to Christianity came to the view that, yes, there is evil in the world, and it is in the form of Jesuits. And they invented some ceremonies that, in fact, tried to cope with that colonizing evil. And what I think we see there is I think we see local Aboriginal people doing ceremony that tries to neutralize the evil of the missionaries, and we see the missionaries getting a glimpse of those ceremonies and thinking that what they're seeing is devil worship. So it just sort of goes round and round.
There's an invisibility factor here, isn't it? Neither culture perceives what the other culture is doing, in effect.
Well, not in the way that that each sees itself.
Every culture in the world has an understanding of good and evil, and thoughtful Christians in all ages, including these 19th century missionaries, would have believed that Aboriginal views of good and evil were God-given. They came because there's a notion of goodness and therefore of godness in the world, and a notion that one should behave in a certain way. And in terms of the most important moral laws, I would say that Aboriginal law and Western law were similar. Thou shalt not kill, and those sorts of things. However, of course, the Christian faith has or had, according to many conservative missionaries, all sorts of detailed regulations about how you should live. And these too, in the view of some missionaries, are sin. So, of course, there is the imposition of not rules about killing or such matters, because everybody knows you shouldn't do that, you know, but rules about how you kept the Sabbath, or, you know, things which really are kind of regulations that are particular sometimes to a particular denomination of the church. But when missionaries started to impose upon Aboriginal people rules and regulations of all kinds about how they lived, what they wore, and so on, missions started to get themselves into trouble and into a situation which was not going to actually help the gospel much at all. I have no doubt that the regimentation and so on, which we now quite rightly criticise, stemmed from this idea that Aboriginal people's whole lifestyle had to be totally changed into a European lifestyle.
They made them wear clothes and made them only have one wife. Like, my grandfather had three wives. No way was he going to conform to what the white fellow was coming in to tell him what to do. So he ran away. He took his wives away from the community and all his children. And he took the rest of the clan with him so that they can continue to live the way that they've been living for thousands of years.
The missionaries themselves were coming into a new and difficult land, and also a frontier situation, where their evangelical work aside, they had to survive themselves.
Oh, it is so classic. It's almost a parable in itself of colonization. The only mode of subsistence they knew was peasant agriculture. And they brought it over here and they tried to make it work on the daily. Like almost every colonizing agent almost anywhere in the world, it didn't even occur to them to ask whether their mode of subsistence was superior. They already knew it was. Before they even got there, they knew it would be superior to whatever was there. They started off at one site. They lived off the land as best they could while they were trying to get their gardens growing. The gardens failed and they ate out the whole area. They ended up calling it Hunger Hill. They moved to a new site. They did the same thing. They lived off the land, got their gardens going. The gardens all failed, and the country was eaten out. They went to a third site. This is all in the diary, including how many tons of lily corms were brought in, how many hundreds of geese were brought in. You know, looking at it overall, you see this massive use. They wanted people to come in and settle. So it wasn't just them. They insisted everybody who converted had to come in and settle and become a farmer. And they could not actually feed those people. So they had to do a kind of surreptitious hunting and gathering that wasn't nomadic and killed the area in which they were living. Went on to another one. So their third site, they were learning more about trying to do agriculture in the tropics. It looked like it might have had a bit more success. They also got into irrigation there, which would certainly have given them greater opportunities for success. And really, about the time when it looked like they might have decided to make a go of it, it was just closed down by orders from overseas.
What effect did that have on the indigenous population, who presumably had come to some extent to depend on this mission?
There was the dependency, for sure, which, as much as anything, was social dependency. I think they'd had people getting bush tucker so often, so regularly, that probably that knowledge and those skills weren't being lost. But what really was being lost for Aboriginal people was their own social networks, which are, in fact, the key to gaining a subsistence in that area. Anybody that came to the mission and became Christian wasn't supposed to associate with bush blacks anymore. They weren't allowed to be involved in ceremony. They weren't allowed to be involved in the usual arranged marriages. They're very, very firm and stern on the idea that marriages had to go in a particular kind of way, and it was not the traditional way. So people who'd really made that commitment had made a very major social commitment that cut them off from their own people in some pretty significant and ongoing, you know, long-term ways, because they were outside the system of authority. They were outside the system of law. They were outside of the opportunity even to have a fully adult future. in their own society as Christians. And they worked, you know, they worked really, really hard. They put their own labor into building houses, building barns, building fences, building sheds, planting crops, harvesting crops, caring for animals, slaughtering them, doing, they pickled things, they did, you know, just the kinds of, I imagine these sort of Austrian peasants with their jars of pickles and their jars of smoked ham and stuff. Well, they're trying to do this on the daily, and they're pickling lily corms and things like that. And the Aborigines did all this, and it was Aboriginal land, as we know, although the missionaries didn't see it that way. And I guess for me, one of the really shocking things is that when the missionaries were told that they had to leave, they packed up, they left, they sold the land, they sold the crops, they sold the animals, everything was gone, and the Aborigines, whose land and labor it all was, were left with absolutely nothing.
Just surviving bound three parties together in northern Australia. The pastoralist brought his herds to grow beef on land which had always been the hunting ground of Aborigines. The Aborigines, now made hungry, speared his cattle, and in reprisal, the pastoralist frequently hunted them off what had been their own land. Now they needed shelter and refuge, and missionaries too could go hungry.
Indeed. They needed to survive, and they don't know how to survive in the land. They don't know how to hunt and fish and dig up lily roots or whatever else they've got to do to survive if you're an Aboriginal person. But of course you can see from the Aboriginal person's point of view, these bags of flour and so on arrive, this sort of huge amounts of food arrive at the mission. In other words, they were able to command and somehow, you know, food arrives.
What you had was you had primarily Lutheran, Anglican, Catholic, and each of them was trying to appeal to the children, as they always had, and what they were offering was boiled lollies. I've talked with one old man, and so if there were different times, this young man said, well, you attended the Catholic one and got some boiled lollies there to encourage you to become a devout Catholic, but you also then whipped down to the Anglican one where you got some more boiled lollies and over to the Lutheran if you could. And nonetheless, that man did become what I would consider a devout Christian, at the same time as remaining a very strong traditional Aboriginal leader.
Yes, our missionaries did use food to attract Aboriginal people. You could say that was a kind of a trick, you know, we'll provide some food and get them in here and then we can preach the gospel. But don't forget, many missionaries arrived when Aboriginal people were being excluded from land, were not able to hunt over their lands, were being fenced off from the waterholes, and they often found Aboriginal people suffering malnutrition. And many, many, many missionaries who fed Aboriginal people didn't feed them simply to trick them to coming into the mission. They fed them because they were hungry. And I think that that aspect of mission is one we've lost. It's one that we don't hear so much about. I've tried to redress that in my writings. But often the missionaries who did the kindest and most charitable and most humane things never spoke about them much, didn't write them down. They don't get into the stories of a mission. And yet these are the people whom Aboriginal people remember. And I had the privilege of reading the diary of Nell Harris, and these are just some phrases taken out of a year of Nell's life.
Napaim had leprosy and Mrs. Dyer used to bandage him every day. Once Paddy was bitten by a snake. My sister-in-law Kate saved his life, sucking the poison out of his leg. Rhoda is very ill. Miss Dove has been looking after her for weeks, but I think she'll die. Budaba, Nabilia's sister, died in our home. She was indeed a lovely child. Mulanjara had a stillborn baby. We attempted to remove the placenta, but without success. Valeria was in a heavy sleep when she fell into the fire and her hand was almost cooked. I dressed the hand and other seriously burned parts of her body with tannic weed and hydrous wool fat, the only things I had. Solomon had a fall from a tree. I nursed him as best I could until the 26th of October, when he died.
Christian missions had a very long tradition of providing health care as part of their approach to proselytising.
Senior lecturer in education at the Northern Territory University, Suzanne Parry.
Building up through the 19th century, there was a focus on health. You know, if we can take care of people, provide comfort in times of illness, then we will have an empathy with them, you know, a means of reaching them, and so we will be able to pass on the Christian message.
How successful were they?
In lots of ways, very successful. For instance, they were able to attend to traumas from hunting accidents, from other sorts of traumas and wounds. So they were able to set bones, do all of those sorts of things. They were able to provide the drugs to very, very rapidly cure yaws, and that was very impressive. And, of course, in other ways, their presence and their setting up of mission stations and their deliberate policy of trying to get people to settle at mission stations had a very negative effect. Very noticeable was the very quick deterioration in levels of health because of the diet. The missions tried to establish self-sustaining communities where there were fruit and vegetables and things available readily, but the number of people being attracted to mission stations, the difficulty of cultivation of agriculture in the north tended to mitigate against them being able to supply high levels of a good diet. So the general diet was very, very mediocre. That led to low levels of health. And of course, once people were together, people coming in with infectious diseases, for instance, measles and chickenpox, had a really disastrous effect. The mission reports, particularly through the 1930s, for instance, record really distressing outbreaks of chickenpox and measles and influenza with diarrhea and those sorts of things attached, which were really devastating.
Smoking is a dynamic in this process, isn't it?
It is, because the tobacco ration was seen to be very much a part of the way of attracting labour to work in mission gardens, for instance, a way of getting people to remain at the mission. It was very much a part of the exchange, even though it was only a very small reward for the level of employment. But nevertheless, it was very persistent. And of course, we know about the dangers of health. Even though that wasn't recognised in the ways that we know it today, there was from time to time a level of disquiet amongst some of the missionaries, more because they could see the dependency on it rather than for the health. And they thought that for a group of people to be confined to a mission station because of their dependency on tobacco was detrimental to the group itself. And you may be aware of the protests from amongst the Church of England missionaries out at Owen Pelly in the 1950s, where some of the missionaries refused to continue with the tobacco ration, and it really meant a serious crisis in the establishment of the missions.
Education lecturer Suzanne Parry. But did day-to-day issues like health distract missionaries from their role as spreaders of the gospel?
I think that was very quickly the reality. A number of the missionaries were writing back to their mission boards saying that, you know, in the course of a day and each day going by, course of a week, a month, that they had very, very little time, in fact, to devote to spiritual matters amongst the Aboriginal people. They were spending their entire day looking at the physical survival of the mission station itself. So the establishment of buildings, which deteriorated very quickly, the establishment of agriculture, which was very, very demanding, even things like the supplies to the mission stations. That was very time consuming, and so two or three missionaries might be assigned to one station, but they spent almost the entire day maintaining themselves.
And often, as we've seen, dependent for supplies from their secular neighbours, nearby pastoralists.
Yes, from time to time they are, especially in the early days when their supplies were slow in coming by boat from Thursday Island. Often they have to go to the pastoralists. to get flour or get essentials that they need to survive. And sometimes it's a very meagre kind of survival they're able to eke out. They have good relationships with some pastoralists, but there is this early history of a bad relationship with their immediate neighbours. And there is a long correspondence of the pastoralists in the area pressing for police protection from the mid-1890s onwards. So there has been this organised hostility towards Aborigines, a desire for a police presence that would disperse Aborigines, hunt them off their land, kill them. And so the mission, in a way, is it's experienced a bit ambiguously by the pastoralists, because they see it's concentrating Aborigines in a place where they can't get to them, which gives, in the kind of struggle over land, Aborigines some advantage, because they can retreat to a place that they can't just come and be run down or shot in. And then later on, of course, the mission becomes a very good place to recruit pastoral labour from. But that's after the passing of some time, and I think there is a couple of stages of development between the pastoralists and the mission and the mission Aborigines.
Aboriginal people always knew which pastoralist would treat them decently and which pastoralist would not. And I know that around Roper River Mission, before the missionaries came, Aborigines knew which station to run to if they were being shot. So there was a variety among pastoralists. And certainly the missionaries and pastoralists also came to depend upon each other. The missionaries did provide for pastoralists medical care, as they did for Aboriginal people, the rites of passage of baptism and marriage and so on. So there was a relationship between missionaries and pastoralists too, and not all of it was negative.
You're with Hindsight on Radio National. I'm Bill Bunbury, and we're exploring religions old and new in Northern Australia.
Missionaries were, from the earliest days, very active in bringing to light atrocities that were committed. We know full well that many mission stations were refuges, havens for Aboriginal people who were escaping danger from hunting gangs and so on. The Anglican Roper River Mission Station is a very, very good example of that, where the presence of those missionaries enabled Aboriginal people to have a safe haven, and also their presence meant that there was less shooting, less atrocity. And you only have to look at who the missionaries' critics are. The main critics of missionaries in the early days were the police or certain government officials who wanted things to go on as they were, and the presence of the missionaries made it difficult for the land to be settled as aggressively as it was before the missionaries came. Plenty of police accused the Lutheran missionaries of hiding criminals, harbouring miscreants and so on. There was a long history of animosity between the police and the Finke River Mission.
The interests of the pastoralists and the interests of the missionaries who align themselves with Aboriginal interests soon come to be very diametrically opposed. There's quite a celebrated incident in the first decade of Mitchell River Mission where Frank Bowman, a neighbouring pastoralist, is actually speared, and the missionaries feel that he really is the culprit in all this, because he has this reputation of being someone who has shot Aborigines, burnt their bodies, hunted them off their land. And the missionaries make some attempt at resistance to that, but then there are only two or three white people in a whole sea of other pastoralists, some of whom are hostile to them, and they actually have to face hostile posses of pastoralists coming down to the mission to apprehend Aborigines who the pastoralists argue have absconded from their work on cattle stations. For instance, when the pastoralist Frank Bowman is killed at Rutland Plains, his wife becomes quite hysterical, and the missionary who's a priest at Mitchell River goes across to help the situation, he thinks, but he's immediately accused of murdering her husband, and she actually draws a revolver against the missionary, because she said if it wasn't for him and his mission he'd established and giving wire to people and things, that they wouldn't have been able to make their spears to kill her husband. So he's very troubled by this, because he's going there as a, in his view, as a Christian pastor to minister to someone in distress, but he's fully blamed for the murder, and he's so touched by that and affected by it, he doesn't seem to ever want to talk about it afterwards. There are some conflicts, because it must be exceedingly hard for the missionaries, at least, to understand how people could have other whites who they want to ascribe some of the positive values of European civilization to, because that's part of their ideology. They're really puzzled as to how they can act the way they act, but they often react to these whites in a very hostile way. So there is this very difficult white against white conflict as well, the missionaries wanting to be the champions of Aboriginal rights and certainly seeing that they have a humanitarian reason as well as an evangelical reason for being there. But when it comes down to a showdown, being very weak and very powerless and inclined to believe their own rhetoric about how great Western civilization is, how great the rule of law is, and probably being very disappointed that they can't deliver.
Missionaries were usually thought to be pastoralists. A big problem that missionaries had in many places was to demonstrate in some way to Aboriginal people they did not represent the same threat to them that the pastoralists were. There are places where missionaries were instantly attacked, and later on these sort of hostilities died down when the Aboriginal people realised that the missionaries weren't there to kill them or whatever, and later on, you know, accepted them. Certainly there was that frontier.
How did missionaries explain away the difference between themselves and the settlers?
Well, I think they did it with great difficulty, but mostly it was by doing what they did and what they did well, and that was providing some medical care, providing some education, which was for those people an amazing thing, just the whole idea of, you know, learning or a book or whatever. And in the early days, before the sort of rigidity of dormitories and so on, we just had a few missionaries camped under a tree and providing some help to Aboriginal people. They caught on fairly quickly that these people were, not only were they not a threat, but actually provided something which they recognised was of value to them, particularly medical aid. There are plenty of cases where Aborigines were upset that a missionary left and was replaced with someone who didn't have any medical knowledge, and they were actually upset with this because they wanted their wounds to be healed.
The Jesuits, I would say, are a really good example because they were really extraordinarily fearless people. Society along the Daily was absolute mayhem. It was just awful. And the mission did provide refuge. It took a stand against whites who were murdering blacks. It tried to get people out of those contexts where sexual violence and the drugs and alcohol and stuff were really ruining them. And they did have a vision of a harmonious way of living that they wanted to offer people. They couldn't do it, and it was, you know, right up until almost the end, they really didn't understand that they couldn't deliver on what they promised. I think they sincerely believed that they were going to be successful in this thing. And it was a vision that the Aboriginal people also, you know, were able to share. And part of their reason that they were interested in sharing that, no doubt, was the chaotic violence of that frontier situation.
Many missionaries put up with what their fellows in white society would have thought were very, very poor living conditions. My father himself lived in a bark hut with a dirt floor for some of his time at Roper River. But one of the problems is that they were always still perceived by Aboriginal people as having greater wealth, more access to things, to goods, than they did. We might have felt that our missionaries' situations were poor. Aboriginal people thought that their situation was resource-rich. And, of course, the era of the bark huts was passed through as quickly as they could, and they built mission houses and so on for themselves, and so they tended to live in good houses, and in a sort of a circle around them, or a little bit distance, was the Aboriginal camp, where the houses were, if there were houses, were constructed of hessian and cardboard and corrugated iron and so on. Now, there have been a few missionaries, I recall, who worked for organisations like the AIM, the Aborigines Inland Mission, who worked on the edges of country towns with the sort of fringe communities. And there were several of those who lived in humpies made of corrugated iron and ate what the Aboriginal people ate and so on. And Aboriginal people look back on those missionaries with immense respect. But I'd have to say that they are an exception. Now, I have been chided by Aboriginal people. There are missionaries whom I criticise because of their imperialist attitudes or their, or whatever. And I remember, and I'll name him, I remember speaking about Alf Dyer to an elderly Aboriginal woman. And Alf Dyer was a strange man, you know, wore a pith helmet and a gun in his belt and all that kind of thing, and saw himself as King of Arnhem Land. And there were a lot of strange things about Alf Dyer. And I said this to an elderly Aboriginal woman once, or something like that, trying to find out a bit more information about Alf Dyer, and she said to me, "Don't you say anything bad about Alf Dyer." She said, "I have seen Mr. Dyer drink out of the same cup as a leper."
Increasingly, the North was opening up to cattlemen and their herds. And sometimes, for their own survival, some missionaries had to become pastoralists themselves.
Well, the Mission Reserve comes to take a very large amount, and controversially even came to involve the revoking of some of the pastoral leases that had already been given. So there was public controversy at the time about that, because Aborigines were argued by some whites to be being favoured over settlers. There's a very big, and what becomes in time, a very significant pastoral holding in its own right that the missionaries have responsibility for.
There's an irony in this then, I guess, in a sense that they become mini pastoralists themselves?
Oh yeah, I think they build their own small pastoral empire. And Aboriginal labour is used in the pursuit of building up that empire, and bit by bit the church sponsoring that mission seeks to appropriate some of the resources of that pastoral activity to help fund some of its other missions, which were in less conducive places for Western economic activity.
So they really become part of the accommodation process by which Aboriginal people enter the European economy in a way.
Oh yeah, I think by the 50s, Mitchell River Mission is very much into that. It's renowned and has a good reputation as an exporter of Aboriginal labour. There are predominantly men who are going away in large numbers to work often in very distant cattle and sheep stations. And there are also some women who go to work as domestic servants on cattle stations. So by the 50s, it's highly integrated into that pastoral economy.
Missionaries had brought the gospel to Aboriginal people, but what assumptions did they make about the beliefs of the people they were trying to convert? John Kadiba, historian of the Methodist missions in Northern Australia.
They had the attitude that Aboriginal cultures and societies were evil and under the power of Satan. They wouldn't allow them to perform their ceremonies on the mission stations or dances. This was the restrictions that was placed upon them right up until after World War II.
There were a lot of people, like my grandfather, so kept running away from the mission and taking all the family with them. And Nemalat was one of those people. He was one of my great-grandfathers from my grandmother's side. He didn't conform, and he wanted to retain his identity as the man from that country, and in the end the government system got the better of him. He went down to Western Australia to run away.
It's something about the missionary endeavour, especially in those earlier years, that continues to baffle me. I don't really understand from whence cometh this view that they've got the only story. I can understand that if you've got that view, then that, and you think it's a good story, then you want to give it to everybody else. But how you get that certainty in the beginning, I do not know. And what they really would expect that people would become once they'd become Christians is also equally baffling. Father Christen was the one who went mad, was one of the few, I think, who really from time to time had a glimmer that there probably wasn't a place in a Christian community for black-skinned people, as Christian communities were organized in those days. So he had some glimmerings of the kind of profoundly difficult arenas that were being opened up for people by this conversion process. But mostly people just, you get the impression that they just sort of went along thinking somehow it would all work itself out.
It doesn't change very much in the first half of the 20th century, before we start to see missionaries with anthropological training who start to think about Aboriginal people's culture having a worth. I have to say that missionaries were no better than their fellows. That is, most of Australia believed that Aboriginal people had only an English-speaking future. Much of Australia believed that they were to be assimilated into white society, which was not the view of missionaries. in the north, but they certainly had the view that a white kind of life, a European kind of lifestyle, was the lifestyle for Aboriginal people, and so therefore Aboriginal languages and Aboriginal culture was just something that was going to die out. And I can't say for all missions, but certainly the missions that I'm most familiar with, they kind of ignored it. It is not that they fought against it, they simply ignored it on the belief that it would simply eventually just disappear.
The missionaries generally weren't adept at any of the several languages that were spoken at Mitchell River, and most of their instruction in terms of religious sense would be in English. The people who are charged with that kind of religious task, the chaplains, tend to have a very short time there. They don't stay more than a couple of years, and there's often long pauses in between having an ordained priest as chaplain there. So the other missionaries tend to be more, as they're termed, practical people who can keep the daily grind of the mission going, and often they're not large in number. One stage is only one European missionary there. So it's a pretty low-scale thing. Yeah, I think the capacity of the church to maintain a high level of theological input and continuity isn't great.
The missionaries who worked with language, who learnt and used the Aboriginal languages, did Aboriginal people a huge service. I don't know that those missionaries actually thought of themselves as preserving culture. I don't know that they realised what they were doing. They thought that they were learning the language initially to communicate and later on to translate the Bible. But of course the effect of it is that most places where Aboriginal languages are still spoken owe the existence of those languages today to the fact that missionaries wrote down and preserved those languages.
So did preserving the language encourage dialogue between missionaries and the people they hoped to convert? Did they look, for example, for parallels between biblical and Aboriginal views of the world and its creation?
The only missionaries who I've ever heard of comparing Aboriginal legend and mythologies with, say, Norse or Gothic or other kinds of mythologies were some of the early Catholic fathers in the Northern Territory who were highly educated men who knew their classics, knew their Greek, knew their Latin, knew, as classically educated people, all of these stories. And they often likened Aboriginal mythologies to Greek mythology, and they admired Aboriginal mythology. Regrettably, the well-educated missionary was a rarity, particularly in the sort of 100 years following those people. Because churches felt that they were changing Aboriginal people's lifestyle to be sedentary farmers or something, then the sorts of missionaries they looked for were farmers, good practical men.
When missionaries came and preached the Christian gospel to Aboriginal people, how did they react to that? Did they find anything in common with that, with their own beliefs?
Yes, they found a lot of the 10 principles of Christianity similar to Indigenous knowledge, particularly the aspect about the rainbow and what that represented in Christianity is similar to what Indigenous knowledge have of having hope and aspirations for moving on into the future. A lot of that information was filtered down from 3 generations ago to listening to oral stories now about Christianity, and a lot of Indigenous people turn to religion because there are similarities there.
The missionaries also told people they'd be saved, they'd go to heaven. Did that correspond with anything in traditional belief?
Yes, and it's part of our ceremony. When the person is deceased, we go through specific rituals that indicate whether the person has gone to a good place or a bad place.
And that's connected, I guess, with belief in the ancestors, isn't it?
Yes, yes. And again, to do with good and evil.
Linda Ford. But there were some striking differences, biblically at least. Take the book of Genesis, which asserts that man shall have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the fowl of the air and over the cattle, etc.
That's where some of the basic conflict arose, because we believe that we're part of the environment and part of the animal kingdom and the plant kingdom. That's where our conception dreaming comes into play, our Ngiruwat system, our clan totem system comes into play. It shows us how we're related and integrated throughout environment. That's where the ultimate conflict starts to occur.
Is that what happened to your grandfather?
I think so. I think he saw through a lot of the Jesuits and Catholics, and he must have thought, well, I'm not having a bar of that. I'll just go and continue doing my own thing.
What I see Aboriginal Christians doing is taking that abstract universal religion and relocalizing it, bringing it back down into place and putting it right here in this country. And that's how we get these stories of Jesus' footprints on the way into Hermannsburg, or in the area in the Vic River District, where in stone you can see the petrified wood of the boat. There are various arcs around the place. There are places where Jesus has appeared. And all of this actually says, you mob got your ark? We got our ark. It's right here. So it brings those values. It brings those stories. It brings some ideas about a kind of sacred history into this place.
Growing up on the cattle station, I had a lot of my other aunties and uncles and grandfathers and grandmothers and huge, big extended family of Maranungun, Marathia, Maramum, Maratevan, all the family groups from the Bogot Daly areas. And they taught us what they knew about their own different traditional knowledge. And a lot of the key elements, I guess, of Christianity, you can find similarities within our own Maranungu context, our philosophy of life and how it should all be in the balance of what's happening around us and what sort of impact that as human beings we have on our environment and on other people.
Linda Ford with the last word in Religions Old and New, the fifth program in our series View from the North. And a special thanks to the Northern Territory Archives Service for assistance in the making of this series. Readings today, Doug Spencer and Robin Johnston. Next week at this time, the final program in this Hindsight series, More Than Just a Territory, in which we explore both the past and the state of the future of the seventh slice of this continent. And for more details, or to react to what you've just heard, you can also visit our series website. Just go to abc.net.au/rn and follow the Hindsight link to View from the North. Studio production today, David LeMay. I'm Bill Bunbury, and you've been with Hindsight on Radio National. Bye till next week.
Thanks, Bill Bunbury, for our View from the North in Hindsight this week, which you can hear again on Radio National this Thursday afternoon after the news at 1.